It's The Naked Scientist. Coming up in just a second, Diana O'Carroll is here with a colourful question of the week. If you eat too many orange-coloured things, will you go orange? We've got the answer. But first, from the Institute of Neurology in London, is Demis Sarbis, who has traded a career in designing and programming computer games, like Theme Park, to become a neuroscientist. Welcome, Demis.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us. So tell us your story. You started off as a computer science student.
That's right. So my undergraduate degree was in computer science at Cambridge. And so I was having a sort of traditional route in computer science then. And when I left, I set up my own computer games company, which I'd also programmed some games like Theme Park before coming up to Cambridge. So it was a natural progression for me to do that. So I set up my own company in Camden in London, and we grew up to 65, 70 people and, you know, created several games for big publishers around the world. And then around about 3-4 years ago, I decided that the games industry was going in a slightly different direction to the way, you know, I thought it would do when I first got into games in the early 90s. And it was becoming more a big business, big budget, sort of Hollywood type industry where there was less and less room for creativity, I was feeling.
Do you think then that the financiers noticed the scale of this market? Previously, it was a bit geeky, bit niche, not a very big market. It still cost quite a bit because obviously you're saying big teams of people to do this, but the profits weren't huge, so no one was that interested. Suddenly, people realised you can tether a computer game to a Hollywood blockbuster, you can make a fortune.
Yeah, I think partly the realisation how big a business it was, but I think the main problem and the reason that caused that conservatism, if you like, in terms of on the creative sense, was that games became very, very expensive to make because the graphics got so sophisticated. You know, you needed teams of a AAA game now would have easily 50 artists on it. And, you know, the costs of that are just huge. So because it was costing sort of £10 million, you know, for one game, the money men at these publishers would need to be more sure there was definitely going to be a return, which means linking it in with a Hollywood franchise.
That obviously was inconsistent, incompatible with your view of what you wanted to do. So you did the rather unusual thing of take a sidestep into neuroscience.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so underlying, although I was been in the games industry for a long while, underlying all of that, all the games I've been involved with designing and programming actually composed a lot of AI in those games. And most of the games were big strategy.
Artificial intelligence. For the non-initiated like me.
Yeah. That's right. And all the games I wrote, like Theme Park and Republic and Evil Genius, these games, they all involved simulations. And most of them involved hundreds of little computer people coming and getting involved with the game environment. And then most of the games were like, for example, Theme Park, were involved you manipulating that environment and seeing how these autonomous agents reacted to what you were doing. Those are the kinds of games I found fun to play, and they were the kinds of games I found fun to create. But so underlying all of this was my passion. My main passion is actually in artificial intelligence, and related to that, as soon as you start thinking about what artificial intelligence is, then you start thinking about how is it that the mind achieves these end goals.
You didn't get hooked on your own games, did you?
No, well, actually, after you've worked on a game for 3-4 years, you're sick of the sight of it in general, even if it's the best game ever. So
it used to take me about 10 minutes to get bored of them. But some of the strategy games, I think, are terrific because they did force you to think in a certain way. I mean, I was a very big fan of text games in the early days because largely computers were rubbish.
Yep.
And the only thing they could do was to generate spurious streams of text that you could read laboriously. But they taught me amazing language skills. And I think it's partly responsible for why I have an incredible memory for text and words and facts, because you had to remember, effectively, a graphical representation in your head of the text environment that was this computer adventure. And I think that probably had a huge brain training effect on me.
Absolutely. And I think those early games also left a lot more to your imagination, you know, in the way a book would, a great book, you know, it exercises your imagination, which of course, you know, a game with all the latest flashy graphics, although it looks very beautiful, obviously leads less need for visualization and creative powers.
Now, just very briefly, because we are short for time, how did you then actually develop an interest in neuroscience? How did you actually then take those skills that you had in computer programming and start answering important questions about how the brain works?
So, I didn't really know much about neuroscience before I started my PhD, but I did a lot of reading, and it struck me, actually, that a computational approach or an understanding of algorithms or the basic computer science that Professor Bishop was talking about is actually a useful approach maybe to take looking at how the brain works. And in general, most of the people I work with and most people in neuroscience are from a life sciences or medical background, which, of course, is incredibly useful from an anatomical point of view. But there are actually relatively few people in the neuroscience field that look at the brain in a computational way, in a machine-like way, which can give, you know, other insights. Of course, it's not a machine, the brain, but a lot of the things it does are actually relatively machine-like.
And the problem that you've solved most recently, in a nutshell, what was that?
So my most recent study involved trying to accurately predict where someone was standing in a virtual reality room whilst they were lying in a scanner just from their brain scans.
Why is that so difficult a problem to solve, because I thought there are cells in the brain that fire off when you go into a certain place. What, we just read what that activity is, can't we?
Yeah, so it's been known for a good 30 years now that these experiments were done in rats. There are cells that tell you where a rat is positioned in an environment or a pen, but no one really knew what those cells looked like on a population level. So if you were to look at a million of those cells at once, which of course you can't do when you're single cell recording with electrodes in rats' brains. So what I was interested in is if you could have this kind of global eagle's eye view, if you like, of the whole population of cells, that might tell you something different that you couldn't see on the individual cell level.
Is this supposed to therefore be a model or a representation of what's going on in the real world? Are you trying to understand how? Because the person you work with, Eleanor Maguire, very famously worked out how cab drivers have bigger bits of their brains through navigating around London. Are you trying to basically understand how a cab driver finds his way around London?
That's right. We're trying to extend those findings, really, in that we know the hippocampus is vital for spatial navigation and spatial memories, but we still don't know what it is about the environment that is encoded in those memories and is encoded by those neurons and how and why it's doing that. And obviously, you can't carry a 2-ton brain scanner around with you. So the best thing we can do is to record people whilst they're navigating around in virtual, very realistic virtual reality environments.
And when you do this, what did you see? And how does this influence our understanding of how this part of the brain tells us how to get from A to B?
So brain scans work at quite a low resolution compared to single cell recording in rats. So when you look at one pixel, if you like, of a brain scan, which is called a voxel, a 3D pixel, that actually contains about 40,000 neurons. So for our pattern recognition algorithms to work and to be able to classify which location that was related to, it needs several hundred voxels to be active to train the pattern recognition algorithm with. What that shows is that these spatial memories must be represented by very large neural populations codes, so including probably between 2 and 5 million neurons.
Where previously we thought that it was just the odd cell that fired off, now you're saying there's huge populations of cells that join together, they code specific locations.
That's right. And also it says something about the way that they're clustered and structured. So we found that these cells were also clustered quite closely together, whereas previous rat literature suggested that perhaps they were random and uniformly distributed across the hippocampus.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Demis Hassabis from Theme Park Guru. That's on the computer game board, obviously, to neuroscientists and decoding how the hippocampus works. Demis Hassabis from the Institute of Neurology. Ben.